Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, email, Google+, simple ways that you can share Issues Etc. programs with your friends, relatives, and fellow parishioners. Just go to Listen on Demand Archives at issuesetc.org and look for the share feature images posted beneath each audio segment. You're only one click away from telling someone about Issues Etc. The Listen on Demand page at issuesetc.org and look for Share This.
He said, I expect to die in bed. My successor will die in prison, and his successor will die a martyr. His successor will pick up the shards of a ruined society and help rebuild civilization, as the church has so often done in human history.
This is a solid case. Classical historians would sell their grandmothers to get this kind of corroborating evidence for the authorship of secular works of antiquity.
There's countless stories of the praise and worship leaders who end up losing their faith altogether, and it's no wonder. This is a dangerous place to find yourself as the manipulator of both God and man.
This is Mark from Michigan, and I am a lawnmower listener. We love Issues Etc.
I've been saying this for about the last 15 years. As long as we have been talking and confronting as both a culture and a church the issue of same-sex marriage, if you can define marriage as anything other, as something other than a man and a woman, you can define marriage as anything other than a man and a woman. Now, some people say that's a slippery slope argument and it shouldn't be countenanced, but maybe it's one that the Supreme Court ought to consider as it takes up again the subject of same-sex marriage this week. If they concede that marriage can be defined as something other than a man and a woman with a goal of, or at least a potential goal of begetting children, what limiting principle do they put on the definition of marriage? Because everybody wants to redefine it, not just homosexual couples. Welcome back to Issues Etc., coming to you live from the studios of Lutheran Public Radio in Collinsville, Illinois. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Hadley Arkus joins us to give us his thoughts on the upcoming consideration of the U.S. Supreme Court of same-sex marriage. A little bit later, Pastor Tom Baker will be our guest. He joins us for our weekly Sunday school lesson. We'll be doing Paul and Timothy in Acts chapter 15 and 16 in just about a half hour here on Issues Etc. For the next hour, you can join us with questions or comments, 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-6943. Send us an email, talkback at issuesetc.org. Send us a tweet at issuesetc. And our beloved on-demand listeners, the Issues Etc. comment line is just for you, 618-223-8382. Joining us to talk about the Supreme Court and same-sex marriage, Hadley Arkus. He's a professor of jurisprudence at Amherst College, founder and director of the James Wilson Institute on Natural Rights and the American Founding, author of numerous books, including his latest, Constitutional Illusions and Anchoring Truths, the Touchstone of Natural Law. He's also written a recent column, Four First Things, titled The Jiu-Jitsu of Same-Sex Marriage. Hadley, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Oh, good to be back with you, Todd. Thanks for having me.
What is the central question that the Supreme Court ought to be pondering and considering, both in advance of and when they begin to hear arguments on the same-sex case this week?
Now, that's an interesting question, because I put it to him, Justice Alito's a friend, and I put it to him that in that last case, the Windsor case a couple of years ago, he noted that there are arguments about the nature of marriage on both sides, one making the case for marriage and why same-sex marriage doesn't fit, and some on the other side. He's noted that there were arguments about marriage, but he never gave the arguments about marriage. The central questions really are about the meaning of marriage, I mean, and the homosexual life, but the judges aren't dealing with those things. The questions have been, you know, narrowed, and it's very hard to deal with them without facing the substance of it. So the main focus, I think, of this one, is what I think the main focus should be, is what is the limiting principle engaged here? If the court moves to install same-sex marriage, what is the limiting principle here? If marriage is detached from the notion of begetting, that is, you don't need the law to license friendships or to license relations of love. There are many people we love to whom we're not married. The laws of marriage provide just a remarkably apt framework for the commitment that's involved in the begetting and nurturing of children. It indicates that people forego their freedom to quit the association when it no longer meets their convenience. Now, if marriage is detached from that central purpose of begetting, and the laws of marriage detach from their purpose as establishing a framework of commitment, then what confines marriage to two people? Why wouldn't it be available to an ensemble of people just profess to love each other? There's a new surge of the polyamorous in this country. Newsweek said there are about 50,000 polyamorous households. The people have declared themselves to be throuples, ensembles of three. So the question, one question we put to the lawyers trying to make the case for same-sex marriage is, if we install this, what do we say to the people coming in who want to know why they're not permitted to marry the ones they love? Now, I have to, what I want them to get clear on, what I've been praying for them to get clear on is this, that it's not enough to say, well, that's likely to happen. Or we're not likely to see many, you know, polygamy revived. Although, yeah, we are seeing polygamy revived in the South and the West. Because, look, even if it were true that most gays don't wish to marry, that wouldn't provide the ground of principle for denying marriage to this particular gay couple. The other side understands that argument. So I'd say let's ask them to respect the same properties of an argument and say, okay, we may not have many cases of the throuples or the polygamous group or two widows seeking to marry to share their Social Security benefits. This may be rare, but you still have to explain to us what is there in this decision you're putting down that would foreclose that arrangement and to not deny to these people the right to marry the ones they love. So I think that will come out as a question. The other side will try to flip past it. What I think the conservative judges have been spending their time simply arguing in this way, that nothing in the traditions in our constitutional history has ever indicated any awareness of a right of homosexuality or a right to same-sex marriage. And therefore, since there's nothing strictly in the Constitution about this matter, the judges, in the conservative view, the judges would have no authority to install same-sex marriage. The judges would simply leave this matter to legislatures at the local level, at the level of the states, to frame their own laws on marriage. That's what the conservatives do, and it's a losing argument. Because the appeal to tradition, when people appeal to tradition, that means they don't think they can make a moral case for what they're trying to defend. Now, can you explain to us what is so important and valuable and necessary about marriage understood as the relation of a man and woman? Instead of taking on that task, what they simply say is, it's a matter of tradition. That's what it's been. And the recurring answer to that is, well, that's always the line. I mean, slavery was traditional until we ended that. And in an old line, you've got to be able to say something more for a law than to say it's been around here since the time of Henry IV. So the conservatives will say, this has never been part of the Constitution. And the liberal side will say, well, that doesn't matter. We propose that it is now.
So the justices ought to be doing what Supreme Court justices do every time they hear arguments.
They ought to be asking questions
of both sides. And you talk here about limit-setting principles.
Right.
Essentially
right.
Saying, if we accept your argument, advocates of same-sex marriage, what is to stop us from permitting polyamory when the inevitable polyamory case comes to us?
And it is inevitable because what our experience shows is there are groups out there ready to press the envelope and test this at every turn. They will test the principle here. See, you know, you said the right thing, Todd. I made the point in my piece. All I would ask of the conservative judges is do what they normally do. When they raise the question, well, if the federal government can deal with the use of guns near schools, why can't the federal government take over the schools? What is it that the federal government cannot do in displacing local governments? So you have the conservative judges such as Rehnquist or John Roberts saying, what is the limiting principle here? And this becomes part of the tools of the conservative judges. What I want them to do is raise the same kind of question here. It's not really that we're going to be permitting this stuff. We're going to be licensing this. You could give us a decision that provides no grounds for refusing these other claims of the thruples or the polygamous groups. And if that's, you're virtually licensing it. I remember when we did the Defense of Marriage Act in 1996, someone on the House Judiciary Committee raised that question to a young man in Idaho who was testifying. They said, if we do this, why wouldn't this permit polygamy? And he said, well, people back in my area, back in Idaho, aren't much interested in polygamy. But what he seemed to miss is that they're not much interested because the law has rather forcefully foreclosed that possibility for 100 years. And if the law stops foreclosing it, do you have any doubt that in this age of inventiveness in sexuality, that we're going to see more polyamorous and polygamous groups coming forward? We've already seen a resurgence of polygamy in the Southwest. We could only expect that will have a further resurgence. I would just urge my own, at this point, all you can do for Justice Kennedy and these others is to urge them to have a bit of prudence and hold back from taking that step. I quoted in my piece one distinguished federal judge who told me that if, at the lower level, a federal judge said that if they take this step and install same-sex marriage, they're going to convert my courtroom, federal courtroom, into a federal court of domestic relations. You're going to be having a sea of litigation about divorce, about the assignment of children, especially assignment of children where other people are donating sperm and eggs. And some of the federal judges may have the awareness that if they take this step, their lives are going to be transformed. They're going to be dealing with so many offshoots of these things that were never the business of the federal government and the federal courts. So it's a dramatic step to take. And I hope that unless Justice Kennedy just had been bent on doing this from the very beginning, that he himself might hold back by his awareness of what exactly may be involved in taking this decisive step across the line.
Hadley Arkus is our guest. We're talking about the Supreme Court and same-sex marriage. We'll come back to the subject of Justice Kennedy right after the break.
T-shirts, shorts, sun. Get in shape this spring at Arch Fitness of Cottage Hills, Illinois. Arch Fitness offers adult boot camps on weekday evenings and on weekday and Saturday mornings. For more information, check out the Facebook fan page for Arch Fitness or call Kevin Reisick at 618-670-6952. Arch Fitness is located at 127 West MacArthur Drive in Cottage Hills, Illinois. Get A-Fit this spring at Arch Fitness of Cottage Hills, Illinois.
Throughout the 50 days of Easter, sacred music for the world. LutheranPublicRadio.org. Listen 24/7 to sacred music for the Easter season. LPR, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Your comprehensive source for information, teaching, and truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
I just find it fascinating that so many of the issues that are out there right now are based on this false notion that men and women are completely interchangeable.
Molly Ziegler-Hemingway talking about her presentation at this summer's Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
I mean, all these really hot-button issues are based on some confusion about where men and women are equal, in what terms are they equal, and then, most importantly, how are we different, and is that difference a bad thing? Is it a good thing? What does God have to say about these differences, and, how should the Christian think about these differences? So I am so excited to come to this conference and talk about these issues, which animate so much of our political and social and cultural discourse, and also the things we struggle with in the church as well.
You can meet and hear Molly Ziegler-Hemingway making the case for the differences between men and women June 19th and 20th at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference in Collinsville, Illinois. For more information, visit issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the Supreme Court and same-sex marriage. Hadley Arkus, professor of jurisprudence at Amherst College, is our guest. He's written a recent column for First Things titled The Jiu-Jitsu of Same-Sex Marriage. Hadley, you mentioned before the break, Justice Kennedy, and that's where my thoughts have gone as the Supreme Court heads toward at least a consideration of same-sex marriage. He has been quite clear on several occasions, and as you mentioned before the break, over time, that he believes that the only reason that one would oppose same-sex marriage is an animus against homosexuality. Those are his words. Do you think that if the other justices do what they're supposed to do, which is ask these questions and pursue this argument to its limiting principles, do you think it has a possibility of opening Justice Kennedy's eyes?
Nobody really hopes that his eyes are going to be open. We know what he's moved to do. My own piece simply sought to point out to him that you are making a dramatic move here. And if the political jiu-jitsu, just to remind people, is that the other side insists that their strongest argument is that against marriages we've come to know it is that, well, not every marriage of a man and woman will produce children. So in other words, they tell us we not only need a moral justification for law that confines marriage to man and woman, but it's got to be something categorical. It's got to be able to answer the question, is it necessarily true that every marriage between a man and a woman will beget children? Well, the jiu-jitsu is, okay, we want you to apply the same standard. So you take a categorical standard. It may not be that most gays want marriage, but you have to explain why we would deny the marriage to this couple. And it may not be that we're going to see a lot of throuples and a father trying to marry his son or a mother trying to marry her daughter. But tell us the ground on which you would deny it to these. But this is the standard you set. We've needed something categorical to work within the very principle you're laying down. Now, Kennedy has been on this from the beginning, going back to a case called Romer versus Evans in 1996, where he planted the notion that that there are no reasons that could support this aversion to the homosexual life. It's simply blind prejudice, animus, and irrational, which is why I sort of made my appeal to the conservative judges, such as Samuel Alito, to say, well, look, you simply say there are arguments on either side, but you never give the arguments for marriage. We've had some important writing about marriage. Professor George and Robert George has done an important book on the meaning of marriage and what is marriage, along with some of his former students. Why don't we draw on the case making the argument for marriage, so that it wouldn't be quite as easy for Justice Kennedy to say, well, there are no arguments, it's only irrational prejudice, and make his clerks get to work then, trying to give us the arguments that would counter the arguments made for marriage. So instead, the conservative judges say, well, their arguments have been made, but we're not going to give them to you. Which is part of my problem, that the main issue is really, what is the nature of marriage? And with the jurisprudence we're seeing on both sides, liberal and conservative, nothing from those two angles, those two perspectives, manages to touch that central question about what is the meaning of marriage? Why marriage only between a man and a woman?
Can you conceive of the possibility that if the conservative justices were to pose these questions to those advocating for same-sex marriage before the Supreme Court, that the advocates might say, well, there's nothing that would limit, there's no limiting principle here. In fact, we do not believe that there ought to be a limiting principle, that such variations on the theme of marriage, whatever it may be, whomever it may include, ought to be permitted. In other words, they say there's no limit-setting principle.
Now, that's interesting because I quoted a piece a long while ago I quoted one militant, I think it was Nan Hunter, who was a lesbian activist who was in the Clinton administration, who said, really, the purpose behind all this really was to discredit marriage itself, to discredit marriage itself as something having a naturalistic basis, that it founded in the natural differences and the natural complementarity between men and women. For some activists, the whole purpose of the scheme is just to discredit marriage itself as an institution, as something that may be grounded in nature, in a natural order, in certain truths grounded in nature. But that's not something that any of the lawyers standing before the court will be willing to own up to and to take. They will simply take the line that it's not likely to happen. It's a rare case. Let the states deal with it. But once again, the fact that it may be rare does not explain the ground on which you denied. And you could just virtually be certain now that some of the same judges that have struck down the laws on marriage now in the separate states will not be able to explain what ground of principle there is for denying it to these people. Now, I remember years ago when the question was posed in those hearings before the Judiciary Committee, when someone raised the question to Andrew Sullivan, a gay activist, what confines it to two? And he said, well, we think it ought to be two. To which Dennis Prager said, well, if you think it's two, we simply think it's a man and a woman. If you're going to do this through stipulation, you're declaring it two, well, we can simply declare it to be a man and a woman. But what I think is going to happen is that the lawyers, if the lawyers were really faced with these questions, give us the limiting principle. I'm hoping some of the judges, conservative judges, will put that question. The lawyers are probably going to just flounder. They won't be able to come up with it. And the liberal judges, especially Justice Ginsburg and Justice Kagan and Sotomayor, they will not be able to resist coming to the rescue. But they wouldn't be able to solve this any more than the lawyers can. And if they come to the rescue, I'm sure that Justice Scalia and Justice Alito will just obliterate them, destroy their arguments. Now, of course, the other, as my friends and watchers of the court readily note, the other side doesn't care. They don't really care that the arguments are not making sense. They're just going to put their heads down, take the pummeling, and go through it anyway. But my hope here is that if the oral argument goes badly enough, if Scalia and Alito can put into shreds the kinds of arguments that they receive when putting the question, what is the limiting principle, if they could sort of just destroy those arguments, then it's going to be rather embarrassing to come forward with play out on the Supreme Court reports arguments so flimsy that the arguments laid down in dissent offer such an overpoweringly compelling response to the main opinion. With that kind of a prospect, they said, well, maybe there's an outside chance that rather than risk that embarrassment, they'd simply hold back. And what you could tell Justice Kennedy is, look, you did something. You struck down the federal law in trying to prop up same-sex, trying to resist same-sex marriage. Federal law to stipulate that in federal law only a man, marriage involves only the legal union of a man and woman and husband and wife. Okay, you struck that down. Though by the way, I don't see why it is that the federal government may not make those kinds of judgments in the meaning of marriage in the federal code. I mean, who else could specify the meaning of marriage in the federal code apart from Congress? And there are many reasons to do that, with naturalization, taxes, many other things. But Justice Kennedy say, well, why don't you settle for this? You struck down this federal definition of marriage. You seem to argue that the federal government should have nothing to do with it, apart, of course, from the federal courts. Apparently, the federal courts can intervene here to define marriage. But you've created a situation in which marriage will be defined in the laws of the separate states. And now what has to be worked out is whether people married in Maine will be able to carry a same-sex marriage with them into Texas, and we'll have to face those questions. But if the matter can return to the states in that way, then you have the possibility that the states can gin up again their laws and constitutional amendments to bar same-sex marriage, and the federal judges could hold back their hands. Right now, you know, there's pessimism in the air, and we're the only thing we could do is do precisely what you're doing in this program, Todd, which is to look again very closely and alert the people in favor of same-sex marriage what a portentous thing they are putting in place in remaking one of the most fundamental institutions of our laws, an institution that is bound up with the very matrix of the laws. I mean, we've had laws on marriage as long as we've had marriage. That's the point of it.
I'm wondering two things here. First of all, in a nutshell, what's the best we can expect when the court hears this and when they make their decision?
The best we could expect is that they will not venture beyond the decision they made in the Windsor case, that the definition of marriage must be supplied under the laws of the separate states, which would mean the laws of the place in which the couple happens to be domiciled. If they did that, at least then the question would still be open in the separate states of what the separate states would respect as marriage. But the question will arise again as to the other part of the Defense of Marriage Act. Can couples use the full faith and credit clause of the Constitution to carry their same-sex marriage formed in Maine, carry it to Texas? You know, the full faith and credit clause of the Constitution that leads us to expect that the driver's license granted here will be respected, the marriage granted in one place will be respected in another. But we sought in that Defense of Marriage Act to prop up the authority of the states to refuse to recognize these marriages coming in from abroad. Now, if that's not there, if they can't do that, then that's a way of indirectly accomplishing the same result of nationalizing same-sex marriage. Because you'd simply say that if you said, by simply getting married in Maine or getting married in Vermont in the same-sex marriage, you may now carry that marriage back to your home state. Well, that essentially accomplishes the same result, you see. So the best we can hope for is an arrangement in which Justice Kennedy is, in fact, willing to settle in with a judgment. Settle in is good enough with the judgment he set down in the Windsor case that the federal government should stay out of this matter, that the laws on marriage should be provided by the states in which a couple has a domicile. And that's what Chief Justice Roberts sought to emphasize in his own opinion in that case, that as he understands it, the case extends no further than that. Of course, that was just wishful thinking, because as John Roberts knew, the case has a dynamism. And Scalia pointed this out a long time ago when in the Lawrence versus Texas back in 2003, when the Supreme Court struck down the laws on sodomy in Texas. Justice Kennedy wrote the opinion. And Kennedy said that, insisting that homosexual couples, gays or lesbians, have a certain claim, right to autonomy in their private relations, that does not entail, he said, any further commitment to any formal recognition in the laws of the homosexual relation. That is to say, did not necessarily entail a judgment about marriage. But Scalia said, rightly, do not believe it. The very dynamism, the very principle, the very reasons at work in this case, of course, argued for same-sex marriage. And in fact, it took only about 6 or 7 months before the Supreme Court in Massachusetts struck down the laws of marriage in our state and invoked in support of their judgment not anything in the Constitution or laws of Massachusetts, but the whole holding in Lawrence versus Texas. And you see how that's played out. Look how it goes. Romer versus Evans in 1996, that the aversion to the homosexual life can have no reasoned basis. It's simply an irrational animus. And then the same thing is said in 2003. And now the question is posed, is there a justification for confining marriage to the relation of a man and woman? And the answer now coming forth is, well, the only reason to oppose this arrangement of same-sex marriage is an aversion to the homosexual life. And we've already established that that aversion is utterly irrational, which is to say, it cannot be justified. In which case we say, there is no justification to these laws that have been on the books for hundreds of years now in confining marriage to man and woman. The premise is already in place. As Scalia said, it was just a matter of waiting for the next shoe to drop. The logic's been put in place. Everything is there. The same five judges are there to put the decision across. And the only thing that could possibly divert them at this moment, I think, is that sense of things I've tried to bring forth in my piece in First Things, that in making this, in letting that last shoe drop, to switch the metaphors now, we are crossing a very decisive line. And so many ripples are going to come out of this one, and it's going to have a transforming effect not only on marriage and our institutions and sexual arrangements in this country and the erosion of family and marriage, but it's going to have a corrupting effect, I think, in many other parts of the law. Well, that's not a cheery sentiment for the day, is it?
Not at all. Hadley Arkus is professor of jurisprudence at Amherst College. He's founder and director of the James Wilson Institute on Natural Rights and the American Founding, author of numerous books, including his latest, Constitutional Illusions and Anchoring Truths, The Touchstone of Natural Law. He's also written a recent column for First Things titled The Jiu-Jitsu of Same-Sex Marriage. You can read this column, and I recommend that you do, at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Hadley, thank you very much for your time.
Oh, thanks for having me, Todd. Thanks again.
When we come back, we're going to be doing our weekly Sunday school lesson. Pastor Tom Baker will be our guest. We'll be in Acts chapters 15 and the very beginning of 16, talking about Paul and Timothy. We talk to the biggest names in religion today, liberal bishop John Shelby Spong.
I don't think Jesus ever preached the Sermon on the Mount, for example. I don't believe anybody ever took five loaves and two fish and fed 5,000 people. I don't believe that's possible to do.
Liberal Bible critic Bart Ehrman.
There's a difference between what the historical Jesus actually said and what the Gospels say he said. And to understand what the historical Jesus was really like, we have to get behind the Gospels.
Muslim critic of Christianity Reza Aslan.
By definition, the resurrection is an ahistorical event, and so therefore historians have no right, no business commenting upon it.
Where else on Christian radio will you hear these guests challenged with important questions? Talk radio for the thinking Christian, Issues Etc. Listen live or on demand at issuesetc.org. Bethany Lutheran College is pleased to sponsor Issues Etc. and Lutheran Public Radio. Bethany Lutheran College is located in the picturesque river town of Mankato, Minnesota, and is committed to making Christian higher education affordable for all with generous financial aid packages available. At Bethany, you'll find stimulating academic programs, a friendly atmosphere, and opportunities to grow both in intellect and in your faith, all within the framework of a supportive Christian environment. For more information, visit us on the web at blc.edu.
Steadfast Lutherans, people who believe the law condemns everyone and should be preached to the fullest. People who believe the gospel is for everyone and should be preached to its sweetest. Traditional Lutheran doctrine and practice deliver every Sunday this law and gospel, that Christ was crucified for us sinners. To all who received him, who believed in his name, the Gospel of John says, he gave the right to become children of God. To see how Steadfast Lutherans preserves this good news for everyone, visit steadfastlutherans.org.
Smartest listeners in radio. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Whether vacationing in Branson or boating on Table Rock Lake, Shepherd of the Hills Lutheran Church in Kimberling City, Missouri is your Christ-confessing congregation. Every week, Christ comes to us through the preached word and sacraments, by which we are strengthened and kept in the one true faith. So come to where Christ comes to you. Come to Shepherd of the Hills Lutheran Church, 103 Kimberling Boulevard in Kimberling City, Missouri. For more, see our website at sothl.com.
Did you know that Luther Academy has been providing continuing education for confessional Lutheran pastors and lay people worldwide for more than 20 years? Luther Academy promotes confessional Lutheran theology through conferences, scholarly exchanges, and publications like Logia, the Confessional Lutheran Dogmatic Series, and Luther Digest. Find out more about Luther Academy and sign up for their free email newsletter at lutheracademy.com. lutheracademy.com.